Imagine finding out that your country spends $5.3 trillion a year on healthcare.
I mean, that is just a staggering amount of money.
Right, more than any other nation on earth. And you would probably assume, with that kind of price tag, that you're buying the absolute best health outcomes in human history.
You certainly hope so.
But then you actually look at the data and you discover that this massive, unprecedented price tag is actually buying you the right to die nearly 3 years earlier than people living in peer nations.
Yeah, it's bleak. You're essentially paying a premium for a shorter life.
It is a stunning paradox. And, you know, when you encounter a statistic like that, your first instinct is to look for a singular villain.
Right, like a glaring, flashing red light on the national dashboard.
Exactly. Something that clearly points to one primary disease that we just need to fight in order to fix the whole system.
But when you actually look at that dashboard, nothing is clear.
No, not at all. Depending on which button you press, a completely different disease flashes red. The data doesn't give you one simple enemy, it gives you a dozen seemingly contradictory ones.
Which is incredibly confusing for the average person.
Welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive into the source material. Today, our mission is decoding a massive, brand new release, the American Health and Disease Burden 2026 Public Health Intelligence Report.
Yeah, published this July by the American newspaper and American TV.
If you are someone who wants to cut through the constant information overload, you have probably seen endless conflicting headlines. You know, one day the biggest threat is heart disease.
Then the next day it's obesity.
Right, and the next day it's mental health. So today we're going to arm you with the ultimate intellectual tool to understand exactly why those headlines conflict.
And how you can read them like an expert.
Yeah.
Because it really is an essential tool for anyone trying to navigate modern health information.
Absolutely.
Without it, you are entirely at the mercy of whatever single metric a specific journalist or researcher decided to highlight that morning.
Yeah, completely divorced from the broader context. So, okay, let's unpack this. The core thesis of this 2026 report is actually a bit of a paradigm shift.
It really is.
They lay it out right in the executive summary. There is no single scientifically valid answer to the question, what is the most common disease?
Because the answer completely changes depending on how you define the word common.
Right, like are we measuring prevalence, incidence, cost? Or, you know, mortality.
What's fascinating here is that the word common is actually a linguistic trap.
Oh, totally.
It's a shortcut that completely obscures the complex reality of population health. The report outlines eight entirely different phenomena that we track to measure disease burden.
Eight different ways just to measure burden.
Exactly. For example, a chronic disease might affect tens of millions of people, making it incredibly common in terms of sheer numbers.
Right.
But it might cause very few direct deaths in a single year.
Or conversely, you have an acute infection that produces a massive spike in sudden hospital visits, but completely vanishes from the population a few days later.
Precisely. So if you ask what the most common disease is, you first have to define your terms.
Common in what way? Right.
Yeah. Are we counting who is currently living with a condition, who is dying from it, who is utilizing emergency services for it?
Or what is quietly draining our economic resources?
Exactly.
I want to build a framework for you, the listener, to really visualize this, specifically looking at those first two concepts, prevalence versus incidence.
I love this analogy.
Think of disease burden like a major city's traffic system. Prevalence is counting every single car parked in every driveway, parking garage, and side street across the entire city.
Just sitting there.
Right. It's a snapshot of everything that just exists there, quietly taking up space. Incidence, on the other hand, is counting only the cars that are actively crashing on the highway today.
And that distinction changes everything about how we view the data. Prevalence shows us the underlying permanent landscape of health.
While incidence shows us the immediate daily disruptions, let's look at the parked cars first. The conditions people live with every single day. The survey data for adults in this report is just staggering.
It really is.
When we look at prevalence, hypertension affects 47.7% of adults.
I mean, that is almost half the adult country walking around with high blood pressure.
Yeah. Prediabetes is at 42.6%. Obesity is at 40.3%. And of that, severe obesity sits at 9.4%.
And we also need to acknowledge the daily quality of life conditions that rarely make the front page.
Right, the silent ones.
Yeah, they represent a massive, constant hum of medical need. The report notes that 31.7% of adults deal with some form of allergy.
Wow, almost a third.
Yeah, seasonal, eczema, food allergies, and 24.3% live with chronic pain.
But when I read through these prevalence numbers, I noticed a terrifying caveat.
The blind spot.
Exactly. The numbers we just listed, the 47.7% for hypertension, the 42% for prediabetes, those are from broad, measured surveys.
They are not just a tally of what doctors have officially written down in patient charts.
Which means there is a massive gap between what exists in the population and what the medical system actually knows about.
It is arguably the most alarming blind spot in the entire report. We are talking about tens of millions of undiagnosed Americans.
That's just wild.
Let's look at the mechanics of why that happens. Take prediabetes, for instance. About 8 in 10 people who have it are completely unaware.
8 in 10?
Yeah. Or look at chronic kidney disease or CKD. It affects an estimated 14% of adults, which is roughly 37 million people.
Okay.
Nearly 9 in 10 of them do not know their kidneys are actively struggling.
That is terrifying.
Even with full-blown established diabetes, which affects 12% of the population, or 40.1 million people, 27.6% of those cases are completely undiagnosed.
I want to pause on the why here, because why is the blind spot so massive? Is it just that people are avoiding the doctor, or is it the nature of the diseases themselves?
Well, it's a combination of both. Conditions like hypertension, early stage kidney disease, and prediabetes are largely asymptomatic.
Right. You don't feel it.
Exactly. You don't feel them damaging your cellular architecture. Unless you have a medical system that proactively hunts for these conditions through universal accessible screening.
Which we don't.
Right. They remain invisible until they cause a catastrophic failure. Our healthcare system is largely reactive, so these quiet conditions simply fly under the radar.
Let me push back on this for a second because I'm looking at this hypertension stat and struggling to make sense of it.
Okay, go for it.
Nearly half the adult country has hypertension, but the report explicitly notes that only 20.7% of adults with hypertension actually have it controlled.
Yeah, it's a very low number.
So if half the country has a disease and 80% of those people aren't managing it successfully, I have to ask, is the medical system just fundamentally broken? Or honestly, are the medical goalposts for what we call a disease just set way too broadly?
That's a fair question.
Because if almost everyone is categorized as sick, what does sick even mean anymore?
That is the core philosophical tension in modern epidemiology. Okay. It is easy to look at those numbers and assume the medical community is just over-pathologizing normal human aging.
Right, like maybe blood pressure just goes up.
But those goalposts like setting the threshold for high blood pressure at 130 over 80, they aren't arbitrary.
Oh, they aren't.
No, they are set there because long-term actuarial and clinical data show that is the exact inflection point where microscopic vascular damage begins.
Okay, wow.
The system isn't overdiagnosing. Rather, it is failing at continuous long-term behavior and metabolic control. The damage is real. It's just very slow.
Which perfectly sets up the contrast with incidence, if prevalence is the slow, quiet damage of all those parked cars.
Incidence is the explosive chaos of the cars actively crashing on the highway.
Right. And when we shift our focus to incidence, new cases, or acute illness episodes occurring in a given year, the leaderboard of diseases completely flips.
Completely. We are no longer talking about chronic metabolic issues. We are talking about sudden, aggressive disruptions.
Like the flu.
Exactly. During the 2024 to 2025 flu season, which the report characterizes as a high severity season, there were between 43 and 73 million symptomatic illnesses.
That is millions of people suddenly knocked out of work, out of school, needing immediate symptomatic relief.
Generating anywhere from 19 to 32 million medical visits in just a compressed few months.
Just massive traffic jam.
Another glaring example is sexually transmitted infections. The report estimates more than 26 million new STIs annually.
Wow.
But here we run into another data trap. Only over 2.4 million cases of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis were actually reported in 2023.
Wait, I need to make sure I heard that right.
Yeah.
26 million estimated new infections, but only 2.4 million actually reported.
Yes.
That is a 10-to-1 discrepancy. How does incidence data get that disjointed?
Because incidence data often relies entirely on what gets processed through official lab channels. With STIs, you are dealing with a massive number of asymptomatic cases.
Ah.
combined with intense social stigma and significant barriers to testing access. Plus, with acute episodes like respiratory viruses or STIs, the same individual can be infected and counted multiple times in a single year.
So the most common disease by incidence will almost always be an infection.
Which paints a totally different picture than the most common by prevalence.
Okay, so we've mapped out the two different realities. We've got the silent chronic issues, the parked cars slowly deteriorating.
And we've got the sudden acute episodes, the crashes on the highway.
But eventually the unchecked chronic issues and the severe acute infections both lead to the same destination, the hospital.
Always.
And that inevitably triggers the financial reality. Here's where it gets really interesting. The spending data in this report is genuinely hard to comprehend.
It's mind-boggling.
In 2024, U.S. national health spending reached $5.3 trillion. That breaks down to $15,474 per person per year.
Just incredible.
And when you isolate where the largest chunk of that money goes, hospital care alone accounted for $1.63 trillion.
And we need to look at what specific conditions are driving that hospital spending.
This was the most shocking data point in the entire report for me.
Oh, the inpatient costs.
Yeah. I assumed the most expensive inpatient condition would be something related to major trauma, like car accidents or complex cardiovascular surgeries.
Most people do.
But according to the 2022 data in the report, the single most expensive inpatient condition is septicemia sepsis, coming in at roughly $60 billion. Why sepsis? Sepsis isn't a root disease like cancer. It's a complication, isn't it?
It is. And that is exactly why it costs $60 billion.
Mm.
Sepsis is the body's extreme, life-threatening response to an infection. It is the ultimate downstream consequence of a failure in early intervention. An untreated urinary tract infection in an elderly patient with unmanaged, undiagnosed diabetes can rapidly cascade into sepsis.
So it's a domino effect.
Exactly. The fact that a late-stage complication is our most expensive hospital line item proves that we are spending our trillions attempting to pull people back from the absolute brink,
rather than managing the root causes earlier in the timeline.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that $5.3 trillion number and the $60 billion spent on sepsis brings us back to the international paradox I mentioned at the very beginning of this deep dive.
Right. The United States spends roughly 2.5 times the OECD average per person on healthcare.
And for context, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, represents our high-income peer nations, economies like Germany, Japan, the UK, and Canada.
Right. We spend 2.5 times more than they do. Yet our life expectancy at birth in 2024 was 79.0 years.
Which is pretty low for that tier.
Now, the report notes that is up slightly. An increase of 0.6 years from 2023, but it is still 2.7 years lower than those peer nations.
2.7 years.
We are outspending the world to lose nearly 3 years of life. How is that mechanically possible? What are we actually buying with $5.3 trillion?
We are buying world-class rescue care.
Rescue care.
The report is very specific about where the U.S. excels. If you have a heart attack or a stroke in the United States, our 30-day survival rates are fantastic.
Okay, that's good.
We perform incredibly well on breast cancer screening. We have the technology, the highly specialized surgeons, and the intensive care infrastructure to fight the immediate catastrophic fires better than almost anyone.
We are the absolute best in the world at deploying the emergency tow trucks to the highway crash.
Exactly. Where we fail and where we lose those 2.7 years of life is in the prevention and continuous control of common cardiometabolic, behavioral, and social risks at a population scale.
Because that stuff is boring and slow.
Yeah. We will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to save a patient in the ICU in sepsis, but we completely fail to establish the continuous accessible primary care needed to manage the 47.7% of people with hypertension before it destroys their vascular system.
Wow.
Our healthcare apparatus is built almost entirely for acute intervention, not continuous maintenance.
That structural failure makes sense on a macro level, but $5.3 trillion is a massive abstraction.
It is.
I want to bring this down to the individual level for you listening right now, because this systemic failure to prevent disease doesn't just manifest as a line item in a national budget.
No, it doesn't.
It manifests in the complicated, messy, daily reality of patients trying to navigate their own bodies.
The individual experience of this disease burden is rarely neat or isolated.
The report has a bolded warning that I think should be required reading for anyone looking at health statistics. It says, do not add percentages across conditions.
Because human biology doesn't operate in isolated silos. The categories constantly overlap.
Right. You can't say 47% of people have hypertension and 40% have obesity, so that means 87% of the population is sick.
Right. It doesn't work that way.
As the report points out, the same individual very often has hypertension, obesity, diabetes, and depression all at the exact same time.
Yeah.
In 2023, 76.4% of adults reported having at least one selected chronic condition, but 51.4%, more than half the adult population, reported having two or more.
We treat these diseases like individual anomalies, but multimorbidity is not the exception. In midlife and old age, it is the absolute rule.
That's a huge shift in perspective.
This raises an important question, though. If multimorbidity is the rule, and our system is failing at preventive maintenance, who is actually bearing the brunt of this burden?
Because those broad national averages hide some truly devastating realities.
The burden is not distributed equally.
Not at all. When I looked at the 2024 mortality data in this report, what shocked me wasn't just the sheer volume of deaths, but the stark dividing lines of who was dying.
The demographics.
Yeah. The report uses age-adjusted mortality, meaning they mathematically account for the fact that some populations are just older on average than others.
Right, to level the playing field.
When you look at those standardized rates, the gap is breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
Among Asian women, the mortality rate was 317.6 deaths per 100,000 people.
Okay.
But among American, Indian, or Alaska Native men, it was a staggering 1,213.0 per 100,000.
It is an incredible disparity.
Going from roughly 317 to over 1,200, that is almost a 4x multiplier based entirely on demographic lines.
Yeah.
That isn't a statistical quirk or a minor genetic variance. That tells me there is a massive structural difference in how long people are allowed to live based on who they are, where they live, and their historical context within society.
You're touching on something crucial here. That massive gap is driven by social determinants of health. We are talking about deep geographic isolation from medical centers, chronic systemic stress, historical marginalization, and vast disparities in basic access to that preventative care we've been discussing.
The physiological diseases might be the eventual cause of death on paper, but the structural inequality is the catalyst.
Exactly.
And that grim reality brings us to the ultimate toll. When all the prevalence, the incidence, and the structural failures run their course, we are left with the final two gauges on our dashboard, mortality and disability.
Yeah.
I want to separate these two because I think in everyday conversation, we tend to conflate the things that kill us with the things that make us sick.
They are entirely different landscapes of suffering.
Very true.
Let's look at mortality first, the underlying causes that actually end human lives.
Yeah.
There were 3.07 million registered deaths in the U.S. in 2024.
Over 3 million.
And two giant well-known categories dominated that list. Heart disease, causing over 683,000 deaths, and cancer, with just under 620,000.
So combined, heart disease and cancer caused 42.4% of all deaths. They are the ultimate fatalities.
But the conditions that ultimately end our lives aren't necessarily the ones that rob us of our daily vitality while we are still living.
Exactly. And to measure that, epidemiologists use a metric called DALYS, or disability-adjusted life years.
Right.
Simply put, it is a mathematical way of measuring healthy, frictionless life that has been stolen from you by a disease. It accounts for the years you live in pain or fatigue or cognitive distress.
And the primary drivers of disability are completely different from the drivers of mortality.
What's topping the disability list?
The conditions causing the most years lived with disability are things like low back pain, depressive and anxiety disorders, migraines, and substance use disorders.
That distinction makes so much sense when you think about daily life. A severe migraine disorder or chronic lower back pain might not end up on your death certificate, but it can absolutely steal your ability to work, to play with your kids, or to just exist comfortably in your own body for decades.
It's a completely different kind of burden.
Yeah, it really is.
And frankly, it is a burden that our highly specialized acute care medical system struggles to address. Managing chronic pain, mental health, and complex musculoskeletal issues requires ongoing, highly nuanced, continuous care.
Which we don't do well.
Right. It requires time and behavioral support, which, as we've established, is exactly what a system optimized for emergency rescue is worst at providing.
So what does this all mean? Let's bring this all together for you. The next time you open a news app or turn on the television and you see a blaring headline about the biggest health threat or the number one disease in America, you now have the toolkit to see right through the noise.
You have to immediately ask the crucial question.
How exactly are they measuring it?
You have to interrogate the metric behind the headline.
Are they measuring prevalence? The millions of people quietly walking around with a parked car condition like asymptomatic hypertension?
Or are they measuring incidence? A sudden disruptive spike in doctor's visits from a winter flu wave?
Are they talking about disability? The silent epidemics of low back pain and depression that steal our daily quality of life?
Or are they talking about mortality? The ultimate final fatalities like heart disease and cancer.
Because depending on which of those four gauges you are looking at, the enemy completely changes.
Understanding those differences is the only way to actually make sense of health data, rather than just being panicked by a constant rotation of terrifying statistics.
But as always, we want to leave you with one final thought to mull over on your own before we go.
Right.
We have spent this entire time dissecting these massive authoritative numbers. The $5.3 trillion in spending, the 3.07 million recorded deaths. But there is a quiet, almost buried note in this 2026 report that casts a shadow over the foundation of everything we just discussed.
It has to do with the bedrock of our public health intelligence, the death certificates.
Oh, this part is wild.
The report explicitly warns that death certificates frequently misclassify the race, the ethnicity, and the actual contributing diseases of the deceased. These certificates are how we track mortality. They are how we know what is killing us.
Which means our ultimate data set is inherently flawed.
Think about the massive implications of that. We allocate billions of dollars in research funding, we train millions of specialists, and we program our diagnostic algorithms based on this mortality data.
All right.
If our primary foundational sources are fundamentally misclassifying who is dying and exactly why they are dying, how much of our $5.3 trillion national health strategy is being driven by bad data?
It's like ghosts in the machine.
Exactly. How can we effectively build a preventative health system if the final diagnostic receipts are pointing us in the wrong direction?
We started out this deep dive by talking about a dashboard with a dozen flashing lights, trying to figure out which one was the most important.
Right.
But maybe the scariest thought isn't that there are too many lights to focus on. It's the very real possibility that some of those lights aren't even wired to the right sensors in the first place.
Now that's something to think about.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Keep questioning the headlines, keep interrogating the metrics, and we will see you next time.